Welcome to the University of Limerick Research Impact podcast series. With me today is Dr. Ian Moyles and Dr. John Donoghue, postdoctoral researchers in the Department of Mathematics and Statistics and the Mathematics Applications Consortium for Science and Industry, MACSI, here in UL. Ian and John are exploring the role of bacteria in soils and looking at how mathematics can be applied to tackle environmental and agricultural challenges around the world. So Ian, if I start with you, what are the problems you're looking to tackle with your research?
Hi, thanks for having us here. So we have a couple of problems that we look at. The main one we're looking at to start with is something called the phosphate crisis. There's a couple of things to add there. What is phosphate? Why phosphate? And what do we mean by the phosphate crisis? Well, plants need several nutrients to grow. The four main ones are carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, and phosphorus. Of those four, three of them come from the atmosphere. So they're a bit easier to manage. That's not to say they aren't with their issues. For instance, nitrogen, we've been putting a lot of nitrogen into the soil for crop production, which leads to nitrate leakage into wastewater, which isn't great, but it's easier to manage in the sense that we get it from the atmosphere. Phosphorus is the one of those four which doesn't come from the atmosphere. There are other nutrients, of course. John will talk about sulfur. Potassium is another one, but phosphorus is the next big one that we have to manage. So where does it come from? It's mined. So it's mined as rock phosphate, which was ground up from the ocean floors during the Ice Age. So that means we have to actually extract it, we have to process it, we have to sell it. And there's not that much of it, because as we use it, it goes from the plant, through the soil, into the water, eventually ends up back on the ocean floor through mollusk shells, other fossils. And it won't come back until another Ice Age comes and grinds it back up, which isn't so great for us. So what's the problem? Well, there's two problems. One is there's not a lot of it, and as we use it, we get less and less of it. And two, it's actually localized in a very small region of the world. So when people talk about the phosphate crisis, they liken it to something called the oil peak crisis, which I don't know if people have heard of that, which is this idea that we use a lot of oil. It also comes from a very small part of the world, and we're running out of it. So to put it in context, oil, about 80% of oil is divided into about 12 nations, whereas the equivalent amount of phosphorus is actually in about three nations. So it's in some sense an even worse situation. And many of these nations are in Northern Africa, which has its own political instability problems. So there's this geopolitical issue, which is not something we're really addressing. We're not politicians. The science issue comes in that we actually waste a lot of it. So there was a study in around 2005, and they found that about 14 million tons of phosphorus was put into the ground to produce food, and about 3 million of that ended up on our fork. So the rest of it was just wasted through soil leaching, poor management, etc. So I guess that's where John and I come in to address this crisis.
As Ian said, we're looking at the management of nutrients, partly in an agricultural setting and partly in a groundwater setting. So on the agricultural setting, Ian has usually been looking more at phosphorus, and I've been looking at sulfur. So as Ian mentioned, the primary nutrients, the first few nutrients that the plant will need can come from the atmosphere. Phosphorus doesn't. Sulfur actually can come from the atmosphere. But interestingly, there's this kind of counterintuitive phenomenon that's been observed. So as environmental regulations have tightened up, so between something like 1980 and 2000, the emissions of the likes of sulfur dioxide have been cut in half. But strangely enough, that's actually been a bad thing for plant sulfur levels. So even though acid rain may have many, many negative repercussions for the rest of us, it's actually quite good for the plant getting the sulfur it needs. So as, you know, environmental policy has improved, there's this one kind of smaller negative impact on the plant getting its fix of sulfur. So that's kind of put an emphasis on a better understanding of that particular nutrient and how best to add that into the soil to replace the deficit that's been lost through managing acid rain. So sulfur is also very important, and in many cases, even when the plant has enough carbon, oxygen, nitrogen, and phosphorus, that it can still be deficient if it doesn't have sulfur. So it needs it to produce vitamins and cofactors and other good stuff it needs to grow. So that's the kind of nutrient cycling side of the grant. I'm also going to talk about the second half of the grant is based on groundwater quality. This is, I guess, an environmental issue, maybe more so than an agricultural issue, but it's to do with the treatment of wastewater from housing. And the way that works is that in remote areas, So in many places within Ireland, in some sites that we've looked at in County Limerick in particular, you will have houses that are somewhat remote, and the way that their wastewater, be it from toilets or washing machines or whatever else, is treated is via collection to a septic tank, and then it's treated on site. So it's sort of disconnected from everything else. So you need to make sure that all of the stuff that's in the effluent that can be hazardous to people's health is removed safely, and that you can kind of leave those houses to their own devices and not have to worry about bad stuff happening. The bad stuff in particular is as a result of the wastewater will settle into a kind of percolation area, essentially someone's garden usually, move down through the soil. And what is likely to happen is that the soil itself, through microbes, will remediate the effluent, remove the bad stuff, and allow the kind of clean water to continue on its way. And that's something that hasn't really been very well understood from our point of view, from a kind of soil dynamics point of view. So about different types of soil, different kinds of treatment, how that will affect the sort of the flow of the wastewater, and ultimately affect the chance that the groundwater under the soil will become polluted, which can lead to, you know, rivers and lakes and other things become polluted, which is not something that we want to see.
These are very serious environmental, global food crisis challenges that you're talking about here. But what can mathematics do to address these?
Yeah, this is a great question, which is, what do mathematicians kind of do in general for these problems? So what John and I do is we're math modelers. So what does that mean? Is we work with different collaborators. So for example, in this project, we're working with Chagas, which is an agricultural authority here in Ireland. We're working with some researchers here in UL, Akeem Schmallenberger and his PhD student, who are doing some plant experiments for us at the lab scale. And for the septic tank and groundwater stuff, we're working with Lawrence Gill and his team over in Trinity College. So that's the experimental side of it. What do the mathematicians do? Well, we look at these processes from a chemical or biological framework, however we're presented it to us, and we try to quantify what we can. So, for instance, if we're looking at a groundwater sample in the phosphate case, we might be interested in the pools of phosphorus. So the phosphorus that plants use, the phosphorus that they can't use, the phosphorus that gets deposited, say, when biomass decays. We'd look at fertilizer, so amounts of inorganic, organic fertilizer. How do we differentiate those? We might look at populations. So in our case, we're really interested in the biotics of the ecosystem. So we are interested in putting in bacteria and looking at how do those bacteria respond to changes in fertilization, to changes in the environmental conditions that they live in. And so what we do is this ends up turning into, because we're mathematicians, a series of equations. So these would be equations involving these concentrations, these populations. And we analyze these in various ways with the aim to give some insight into what strategies one should use when changing a fertilization mechanism, when trying to design a new experiment. So something that we can do that it's a bit harder for the experimentalists to do is we can actually run simulations on models, which are kind of like artificial experiments. And we can say, look, we think there's some interesting dynamics going on maybe between this one phosphorus pool and a couple of these bacterial populations. Is there any experiment that you can think of that allows you to isolate that phenomena? Maybe we're seeing that if we can control a certain bacterial population, the phosphorus is better used by the plant, or we need less fertilizer for the same plant growth. And so we can give indication to the experimentalists of what they should be doing, and we can also provide insight into why they're seeing the results they're seeing in the experiments they do. So they might say, we put some fertilization in at a certain period, a certain level, and then after a period of time, they get a response, whether that's measured through an increase in a certain phosphorus level or through an increase in a bacterial population. And we can try to fit our model to certain parameters that they're getting and say, here's why we think you're seeing that response or why you're not seeing that response. And here's what you might do to change it. Or here are some consequences we think might come further down the line from that.
It's something that's worth bearing in mind, something I hadn't really thought about until I started here, but the experiments themselves are very, very complicated to actually interpret afterwards. It's maybe deceptively so. There's so many factors at play within the soil that there is kind of a place there, I think, for modeling. If you have a few simple ideas and sort of see the result of putting those into a model and you ultimately solve it, you get a prediction. And at least that's something that's sort of clear cut. If this particular factor is important, then we would expect to see something else happen. Whereas with experiments, unfortunately, there's an awful lot of different stuff to control, particularly in the field. But there's so many different populations living in there and different plant responses that it was a big surprise actually when starting on the ground itself. It's kind of disappointing in a way. You couldn't really be 100% sure on anything really. There's always a second interpretation and a third interpretation. So I guess that kind of that allows mathematical modeling to hopefully shed some light on maybe fundamentals within it that can then be ultimately tested. So maybe that's kind of a particular novelty of our grant that it is interdisciplinary, and that I suppose the experiments lead to the models, but then also the models will lead to future experiments. Ideally, that we would get a kind of a prediction that could then be tested later on down the line. So it's kind of a feedback loop between the two sides. I think that's kind of maybe quite rare, but it's a nice thing to have, a nice thing to be part of.
Ultimately, you're saying your modeling is allowing science to fail faster, you know, to go and find solutions that will work in the field.
That's part of what we do, yeah, is to save money if we can. There's no point running an experiment for thousands of dollars, sometimes even more, if we can say, look, we've run a simple model and you're just not going to get what you're thinking you're going to see. So we can save money that way. We can vary parameters a lot quicker than experimentalists can. So a parameter being some control in their experiment, they may have to run an experiment six different times, each one costing at least the same as the rest. We can run six at once over a lunch break, because we can run simulations of our model and say, look, here's the parameter set that is worth the money to dig things out. I just want to add two things of interest to complement what John said. One is something that the mathematicians do that people think is a bad thing is we actually like to abstractify. So we'll talk to experimentalists and they will tell us all about their science, way more than we know and probably need to know. And what we do then is we say, okay, from talking to you and from our own intuitions otherwise and talking to other people, we think these are the important processes, and not just necessarily for phosphorus or for sulfur, but for a nutrient cycle in the soil. So we think it's going to have to go from A to B to C to D to plant, something like this. And so what we can do is we can actually start to abstract that model so that we can say, look, here's something and we've tuned it for your phosphorus or your sulfur, but we think this is actually a general thing you can apply to any nutrient in soil. All you need to do is you need to get some new parameters. You need to talk with experimental, see if the processes are dominant in the same way we think they are. But looking at it from this framework helps you do a whole bunch that you couldn't do individually as a collective. So rather than say, I'm a nitrate person, I'm a phosphorus person, I'm a potassium person, it says I'm a nutrient person and here's the model that you'll want to take and run with and here's some code you could use, etc.
I mean, we started off looking at different nutrients, but we kind of realized as we were obviously talking quite a bit during the weeks that we were kind of looking at very similar things, possibly with different names, but that there was a lot of common mechanisms, and maybe that's something that we noticed partly because we were focusing on particular aspects. So it kind of helps, I guess, that you sometimes take a different viewpoint.
The other way that we complement the experimentalists is they'll do their experiments. And what a lot of experimentalists don't realize is they themselves are modelers. In fact, they just don't use the math part, but they'll have their experimental results and they'll present them in the very scientific way. But there's always this discussion portion, which is, what does this mean? Why do I think this is happening? And so when we're on board, our experimental colleagues can say, look, I think the phosphorus is going here. I think it's interacting with this bacteria. And then I think this is being produced. And if we kind of narrow down the discussion and say, okay, if you really think this, let's coin up a quick model and see if we can get the conclusions that you think are following from your experiments. So we can actually strengthen the discussion part and the kind of the future development of the projects by just throwing actual math down on the models that they're already conceiving of conceptually. And so far, I mean, the people we work with are already on board with that concept, but this is the, I would say to anybody who's an experimentalist not working with math modelers, this would be our biggest pitch, is that we can kind of quantify the conceptual models that you would have as the experts in your field. We don't need that knowledge to write down the math models. We rely on just basic physical, chemical principles to write down our equations, and then we can analyze it and see if the conclusions are working out the way they're going.
You've talked about the impact your work is having for experimentalists, but have you seen any impacts yet translated into work in the field or relevance for industry that you might want to mention?
One that jumps out is that we've had some interest from the Limerick County Council on the wastewater site that I mentioned earlier. So they have been monitoring water quality at various locations within Limerick, so I think kind of river and wells, and they were concerned, and still are concerned, about the effects of having too many of these septic tank units close together. So that if you have, I guess, a row of houses and each one has these kind of treatment centers, at some point the kind of the effect of the buildup could then lead to sort of pollution. So they're kind of interested in a way of quantifying that and figuring out if there should be maybe an optimal spacing or a kind of maximal size of a housing cluster. So that's something that we're going to look into and talk with the county council about.
Back in, I think it was September, Rusal, which is a company local to Limerick, invited us out for an industry day because they have a interesting soil problem, which is not related to agriculture specifically, but they have a different effluent when they process alumina. They have an effluent which goes into a soil bed, and there's environmental regulations about how that needs to be managed. And so they actually brought us in to have discussions about how one could model that and how one could improve their environmental impact strategy for the government regulations. So that was, I guess, unexpected industrial impact, which is still ongoing and hopefully will lead to some future development.
Speaking of the future, I suppose, where to from here for your research?
That, I suppose, depends on where we leave it at the end of our postdocs here and where the group is at that point. But when we do have a sort of understanding of basic mechanisms and hopefully have a kind of confidence within those, there's numerous extensions within the mathematical modeling realm and then also future experiments that can be done. So one thing that we were considering adding in would be that if you consider the effect of, say, wandering animals in agriculture, so that the effect of them spreading their droppings is actually a way of closing the phosphorus cycle and could do some kind of interesting feedback loops. And then, I guess, various extensions, as Ian said, to general nutrients and a kind of cohesive framework for understanding these kind of problems, because there is, I guess, less done than you might think in terms of actually understanding the role of microbes in soil and what exactly is important to consider. Once we're done, there's always different strands that you can pick up and hopefully get something fruitful from.
And I want to emphasize how important that is to understand the biological aspect, because I mentioned at the start that from 14 million tons of phosphorus, only 3 million made it onto the fork. So when you couple that with rising food prices and the limitation of phosphorus, understanding the biology mechanism, which would hopefully lead to new fertilization strategies. Why would your average farmer care? Well, from 2006 to 2007, for example, phosphorus prices went up 700% in 1 year. So that would be the incentive alone to improve your fertilization strategy. Even if you got the same food yield, if you can use less phosphorus, you're saving a lot of money, and that's eventually going to catch up to people.
Can I ask you a personal question for budding mathematicians out there who are looking to kick off a career in mathematics and statistics? Have you any advice or would you recommend it?
Can I flip that question first, which is to plug why people should think about bringing math people into their experimental careers? We'll get back to that question, but I want to give a little plug. We have a European study group with industry coming up. These are European, as the name implies, and these are mathematical workshops which run around Europe, and we are hosting ours every 2 years or so. So what happens? Industry groups bring problems to us that they think could use a math support. And industry is a very broad term there. That could be a government agency, that could be another person in a different university department, or an actual commercial industry. And these problems have led to a lot of success for the companies. To bring it back to what we do is, several years ago, before our time, someone brought a nutrient problem to one of these study groups here, and it had to do with nitrate. And we've actually just submitted a paper based on looking at that data, and other papers were submitted on similar data that came from that, and that actually led to this grant and where we are today. So it kind of comes back cyclical, which is, there was a study group, this problem became interesting, we needed to solve it, some money came, some granting, we came. And now there's another study group, which will hopefully lead to the next set of grants for the future. So that's why you should think about bringing a mathematician into your research group.
Come back to your original question. Advice that would spring to mind, without generalizing too much, I do feel like there's maybe a gap between people who sort of just do maths for the sake of it and people who are sort of doing the experiments. So there is a sort of place in between for people, you know, maybe are willing to engage enough with the biology. As Ian said, we won't understand everything because we don't have the proper background, but to kind of tie the two sides together, there is, I feel like, a lot of room there because for various reasons, people maybe don't want to go to that middle ground sometimes. I mean, it's enjoyable and it can be quite fruitful. That'd be kind of the main one I would think of.
Yeah, and I think math sometimes gets a bad stigma as being, kind of hinting on what John says, being this discipline where you sit in a room maybe with no sunshine and just work on these abstract concepts that have no application to anybody. You know, you're essentially an armchair philosopher. Whereas John's hinting at, and I'm the same way, it's much more than that. I mean, we consider ourselves armchair everything, I guess, which is armchair biologists, armchair chemists, and we come in and bring a fresh perspective, which the people we've worked with, it's quite interesting because they get so rooted in their own knowledge, as we do with our knowledge. And so we ask what we think are naive questions, and often that can lead to new insights, kind of like ignorant children just coming in. And
sometimes they are naive questions, I suppose, yeah. But yeah, sometimes they are actually leading to something.
So if the advice, if you want to get into this field, is if you really like science and you just like science as a whole, I think applied mathematics is the field for you because you get to dabble in everything.
Yeah.
Ian and John, thank you so much for bringing the world of mathematics to life for us all here. You've been listening to Dr. Ian Moyles and Dr. John Donoghue, postdoctoral researchers in the Department of Mathematics and Statistics and the Mathematics Applications Consortium for Science and Industry, or MACSI. Find out more about MACSI by going to their website, macsi.ul.ie. This research is kindly funded by Science Foundation Ireland. If you'd like to find out more about research impact or read our case studies, go to our website, ul.ie/researchimpact.